Good morning and welcome back to day two of the National Lawyers Convention. I'm Nate Kaczmarek, Vice President for Practice Groups and Networks for the Society. What a terrific first day we had yesterday, and what a blockbuster Scalia dinner to cap it off. From the courage of our student leaders to the inaugural Madison toast to that lively fireside chat between Judge McFadden and Justices Barrett and Kavanaugh, it was an inspiring evening to remember. Today, we keep that momentum going with another full slate of panels that cover a wide range of law and policy. And we'll wrap up tonight with one of the great traditions of the convention, the 24th annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture, featuring Judge Andrew Oldham. Before we turn to our first session, I want to highlight an exciting milestone for the Society. For more than two decades, we've had 15 practice groups that have helped shape our organization's programming. This year, we've expanded to 21 groups, and by the end of this year, we'll reach 23. That growth lets us take a deeper dive into many important areas of the law, including health, education, the Second Amendment, taxation, and immigration, which happens to be the focus of this morning's plenary session. We're especially grateful to Jean Hamilton, who not only joins the next panel, but also serves as the inaugural chair of our new Immigration Practice Group Executive Committee. Jean's leadership has been instrumental, and we're very thankful for his efforts. For those of you chasing precious CLE hours, don't forget, scan that QR code on the back of your program to sign in and sign out. And now, to kick things off for our second showcase panel, it's my pleasure to welcome Jordan Lamb, former president of the Federalist Society's Texas Student Chapter. Jordan will introduce our moderator. Please join me in welcoming Jordan Lamb.
Good morning, y'all.
Morning.
Good morning. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce the moderator of this panel, Justice James P. Sullivan. Justice Sullivan serves on the Texas Supreme Court. Prior to joining the court, Justice Sullivan served as general counsel to Governor Abbott and as Assistant Solicitor General under then Attorney General Abbott. He also worked as an appellate litigator in private practice and as an adjunct professor at George Mason University. Justice Sullivan was a law clerk to Justice Thomas B. Griffith on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School, where he was articles editor of the Harvard Law Review. He also graduated from Rice University. Justice Sullivan lives in Austin with his wife, Alithia, and their son. Please join me in welcoming Justice Sullivan.
Now these, oh, good, they're live. Thank you, Jay Lamb. She moderated a panel with my old boss, Governor Greg Abbott, so I really appreciate that she would slum it with the likes of introducing somebody like me. It's now my honor to introduce the panel arrayed in alphabetical order here, and we're going to keep it kind of short on the intros because you know who these people are and you know how to read. Akhil Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at it's at a law school in Connecticut, Yale. Am I saying that right?
Close enough.
Long A, Yale. Sounds weird. And clerked for Steve Breyer. And of note, and you can go up the stairs, and his book is there. He's written a lot of articles and books. Most recently, Born Equal: Remaking America's Constitution, 1840 to 1920. So you can get that up at the top of the stairs. To Akhil's left, we have Stephanie Barclay, who is a professor of law at Georgetown Law School and the faculty co-director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. She's published all over the place in academia and popular press. She clerked for Randy Smith on the Ninth Circuit and Neil Gorsuch on the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're very happy to have her here, so give it up for Stephanie. the only time he'll ever be to anybody's left, but to Stephanie's left, Trevor Izzell. So as Jay Lamb told you, I was Governor Abbott's general counsel before he appointed me to the Supreme Court. But in January of this year, GA got a huge upgrade at the general counsel position with T-Bone over there. He clerked for Jeff Sutton on the Sixth Circuit, clerked for Andy Oldham on the Fifth Circuit. And I liked to tell people when he was my deputy general counsel that we averaged one SCOTUS clerkship per man, but that's because Neil hired Trevor twice. He and Keena and their son Ransom live in Austin, doing a great job over in the governor's office. And then to Trevor's left, Gene Hamilton is the president of America First Legal, which he co-founded. He was most recently served as deputy White House counsel to President Donald J. Trump. And he's now back out, still in the fight, but in a different role at America First. Give it up for Trevor and Gene. All right, so let's just jump right into it. We're here talking about immigration and originalism. So Professor Amar, could you tell us what are the tools of originalism and why do they matter when it comes to the pressing issue of immigration?
Thank you, Your Honor, and such a pleasure to be back with my friends at the Federal Society. As I look out, it's a bit of a stroll down memory lane. I see all sorts of friends from way back when, even a Calabrese, but not the one that you might be thinking of. So nice to see y'all. And I say y'all because there are a lot of Texans here, I notice.
Damn right.
And Texas is featured very prominently in the new book. So lots of maps about Texas in the book. But since you talk about tools, my friend, of interpretation, we first met in connection with a great Texan, Sir Philip Bobbitt.
That's right.
Lives, among other places, in Austin. And Bobbitt has a methodology of constitutional interpretation, identifying the tools that people use when they do constitutional interpretation. Three of the tools are text, history, and structure. When you use those tools together in some combination, you're an originalist. Now, different originalists do things a little bit differently, but they focus first on the text of the Constitution and history. History could be everything that ever happened in the, up to this nanosecond, but history for Bobbitt and for originalists is history connected to the adoption of the original Constitution or its textual amendment. So it's not everything that ever happened. It's not Greece and Rome and that would be Roe versus Wade, for example, and that's not originalist. It's history connected, to repeat, to the adoption and amendment of the Constitution. Structure is reading the thing as a whole. Separation, because it doesn't say separation of power, checks and balances, rule of law, federalism. But those are all features. Unitary executive. Doesn't quite say it that way, but those are ways of organizing the document as a whole, as opposed to what, Professor, you ask? As opposed to focusing on the precedents, for example, or merely the practices of government or our traditions, which may not quite correspond always with text, history, and structure, as opposed merely to prudence or what the interpreter wants, supports politically. So, in some combination, text, history, and structure, especially when woven together, that's originalism. And it doesn't mean liberal, it doesn't mean conservative, it doesn't mean judicial activist, it doesn't mean judicial restraint. It's not just about courts, it's about a way of engaging in constitutional interpretation, whether you're a citizen or a legislator or an executive or a lower court judge or a Supreme Court justice. We're going to hear lots of things about originalism. I would say originalism is as originalism does, and you want to look particularly at people who do it all the time across the board, rights and structure, sometimes saying, oh, this is in the Constitution, sometimes saying, oh, this isn't, and see if they have consistent methods across all issues. And ideally, at least sometimes, their views are going to be at variance with their political preferences.
Yeah, if you're doing originalism right, you're probably not going to like all the results if you do what I do now. So Stephanie, can you tell us what are other kind of, so we have some of the tools now. What are some of the kind of the meta theories about originalism that underlie some of the current debates about immigration?
Sure. And thank you to Sheldon Gilbert and to the Federalist Society for organizing this panel, and Judge Sullivan for moderating, and my terrific co-panelists. Before I get into that, I'm sure some folks are in the room are wondering why I'm on this panel. And so I thought I'd tell you what I've been told is maybe one of the most important contributions I can make, and that is to plug Akhil Amar's new book, Born Equal.
Top of the stairs.
Right, Akhil? And it, but I want to tell you, truly, this is an important book. This review by Gordon Wood, who's a big deal, he says that Born Equal is no simple narrative with one thing happening after another. It's the most extraordinary kind of history that I have read. I think that's a high tribute. While I'm talking about books, I will also mention Yonatan Green's book that she's doing a book signing for. Yonatan is a fellow at my Center for the Constitution at Georgetown. He's written a book about Israel's judiciary, Rogue Justice, The Rise of Judicial Supremacy in Israel. And Richard Epstein calls this book a towering achievement. All right, so that's enough commercials. You all can pay me a commission later. And I'm going to now jump into some of the meta theories that are relevant. I think the immigration debates, in a lot of different contexts, put pressure on some of these larger debates about originalism, how we should do originalism, that I think are really interesting. And I wanted to just say, building on what Akhil was discussing earlier, I agree with the fact that originalism isn't any history. Justice Barrett has a great line. She's once said, just because you've pointed to something old doesn't mean that you're doing originalism. So history that is leading up to or shortly after the founding period, I think, sheds context on what those words meant, and that's what we're after. And sometimes those words might be pointing to broader general law principles, but they're still pointing us to some sort of law that we want to interpret and understand. There's other history that might then be important for other reasons. Maybe the judicial doctrine calls on us to look at history from different time periods, like notions of fair play and substantial justice when it comes to jurisdiction. Or maybe we're looking at political precedents, and there's some deference owed to political precedents that have been set, and so that sort of tradition is relevant, but it's different from originalism. Okay, so some of the meta theories that I think are relevant here are your view as originalist of whether or not this is a federal government that has some implied sovereign powers, as my colleague at Georgetown, John McKyle, has argued, or a position that Justice Scalia has taken, or whether you're more of a strict enumerationist and you think that we need to be able to point to any power that the federal government is exercising somewhere listed in the Constitution. And that's an interesting debate that's important for immigration reasons I'll get into in a moment. There's also questions about when is history that we point to, even ratification era history, an example of complying with our constitutional commitments? So history that is indicative of the sort of constitutional values we were seeking to memorialize. And when is history a counterexample? So an example of us falling short. That's relevant in this context, for example, for the Alien Enemies Act that were enacted shortly after the founding. And some scholars or jurists think that the Alien and the Sedition Acts are counterexamples. They're examples of us falling short of our constitutional commitment. And that was certainly argued by Madison and Jefferson. Justice Barrett makes that point in her new book that came out. But then there's counterarguments. There's an article being written right now by Don Herzog, Michigan, that the history is more complicated. There's more support for some of those early acts than we might suggest. There are also questions at a meta level about what we do when there's just disagreement at the founding. Do you take a Wilbodian sort of liquidation approach in terms of how we resolve that disagreement? There was disagreement at the founding, for example, about whether or not the Commerce Clause, if you are a strict enumerationist, is the Commerce Clause sufficient to provide federal power over over immigration? Samuel Sewall, a Federalist representative from Massachusetts, argued that federal power over aliens could be derived from the commerce power, whereas Albert Gallatin from Pennsylvania contended that it couldn't extend that far, that it could only cover the persons of alien merchants and must be related to them as merchants, to their professions, not to their existence as men. And then there are questions about constitutional interpretation versus construction. And there might be constitutional construction required if there is some sort of irreducible ambiguity.
You need to take that? Somebody's phone's ringing. Thank you. Sorry.
That's okay. I thought you were talking to me. Yeah. I was like, I'll get on the line. Phone a friend. So if there's irreducible ambiguity in text, we might be dealing with construction of meaning. Or even if there's not ambiguity, we know what the text meant or what the meaning was, we might still have to engage in constitutional construction in terms of the doctrines that we're going to create to implement that original meaning. And I will discuss that particular issue more when we get into birthright citizenship. But those are some of the meta issues that are all operating in the background. And depending on the position you take on some of those bigger theoretical questions about originalism, that will inform some of the other specific positions you might take about immigration.
And follow-up question, just because it's interesting to me that you raised it, for the kind of ratification founding era proponents of the Commerce Clause being a source of federal authority to regulate immigration, how do they square that with Article 1, Section 9? So one of the only things talking about the movement of persons is about the importation of persons. And you can see how, you know, when persons were under, like when chattel slavery was an institution, then you can see how that would clearly fit within the foreign commerce power. And then it also talks about migration of persons. But I wonder how they would have, how at that time, but you know, they would have squared that with, maybe that makes me too much of an enumerationist, but.
You wanna go first again? Well, so I think one argument is that the piece in the Constitution about migration of persons is sort of just euphemistically referring to and limited to slavery.
Right.
And so it's really not meant to apply to some of these broader issues is one way that you can read that. And also you can make belt and suspenders arguments, like whatever we were doing over there, that doesn't mean that the Commerce Clause was limited to exclude the government's power to operate in ways that had these sort of broader impacts on commerce. I think that's what proponents of use of the Commerce Clause would have and were arguing.
Fair enough.
Akil, do you want to add to that?
I promise I'll jump back in.
Okay, yeah, for sure. It's wonderful that President Trump has lawyers of your caliber, had lawyers of your caliber to bring some of these originalist tools from the ivory tower to the real world of some of the problems that are faced. Can you tell us a little bit about one of the day one executive orders that we saw Will Scharf standing there handing to him and how originalism informed the counsel, the good counsel that the president was getting?
Well, thank you. That's a very good question. It's something that is brings into the forefront the things that we have been talking about already here on this panel this morning, which is which constitutional provision, if you are a person who adheres to a school of thought that says that we can only, the enumerated powers, the control over the ability to provide a uniform rule of naturalization, the foreign affairs power, the Commerce Clause, what is the power that allows the executive branch to control the borders? And I think that we have to take a look at a couple of different things to inform that particular position. If you are a person who, as in many immigration law classes and immigration law practitioners, adheres to the view that the only thing that binds or that provides sources of authority for the executive branch to act when it comes to controlling our borders is the naturalization clause, then you would be a person who says, well, if there are 100,000 people who arrive at the southern border each and every month, and they step 1 foot across that border, then my God, we have to give them an asylum hearing. We have to put them into a process. Because this is the structure that the Congress set up. If you look at 8 U.S.C. 1225, if you look at Section 240 of the INA, if you look at all of these different statutory provisions, it would seem to say, well, you know, we have a process, so we're just going to have to hire more judges and more agents and provide more and more process to adjudicate this mass arrival of people. But I think that's inconsistent. That view is completely inconsistent with how the founders understood the extent of the executive power at the founding of our country. For all of history, all of human history, not just the last couple hundred years, thousands of years, people, societies, have recognized, and this would have not been foreign to our founders, that control over your territory, control over your borders, is an inherent power that belongs to any sovereign nation. The executive power would have been thought to have included the inherent authority to prevent the entry of people into the country. And yet what we saw play out, especially over the last 4 years, but certainly prior to that as well, was this mindset that once you put one foot across the border, that you were entitled to all kinds of process, there was nothing else that could be done. It almost turns into kind of a hokey pokey dance type of legal theory. You know, you put your right foot in, you put your right foot out, that somehow that entitles you to be able to have additional process, and that once that right foot's in, the executive branch cannot do a darn thing except for to arrest you, detain you, and put you in an immigration court proceeding, which is, I think, is completely inconsistent with what the executive power encompasses and what the Supreme Court of the United States has recognized in multiple decisions over the course of our history. In fact, there's a line from the Knopf versus Shaughnessy in the 1950s. The exclusion of aliens is a fundamental act of sovereignty. The right to do so stems not alone from legislative power, but is inherent in the executive power to control the foreign affairs of the nation. So on day one, President Trump issued an executive order called Guaranteeing the State's Protection Against Invasion. And in it, the president cited existing statutory provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act, Section 212F, Section 215A, provisions of law that the Supreme Court, as recently as in the Hawaii case, has recognized exude deference to the executive in so many regards. But he invoked additionally not just those statutory authorities, but the authorities that belong to him, that were inherent to him in the executive power, and as a way to fulfill the federal government's guarantee to states to protect them against invasion. And so what we have seen since the issuance of this particular executive order is an unprecedented securing of our border. The number of releases of illegal aliens into the United States since April, when they were even very, very minimal, has been zero. Zero. For month after month after month. And this is after millions of people poured over the borders over the last 4 years. And so what does this all mean? How does this relate to this debate that we're having? I think that the president's position, as expressed in this order, is more consistent with an originalist understanding at the time of the adoption of the Constitution of what the federal government could have done to protect its own borders without requiring necessary implementing legislation from the Congress to actually do something to act.
Thank you. And so to the extent that, you know, debacle and all of that, that it's inherent in the nature of sovereignty, Trevor, you are now giving good counsel to a different commander-in-chief and CEO of the sovereign state of Texas. And so in the discussion of immigration, you know, especially after Arizona against the United States, you know, everybody wants to kind of say, eh, that's just kind of a federal thing and keep to yourself. But, you know, I know that that you know, the governor and the state of Texas is grateful that the president is now taking seriously its Article 4, Section 4 obligation to defend the states against invasion. But from where you sit, counseling the commander in chief of a different sovereign, how do you come at the immigration originalism issue here?
It's a great question. Thank you. I'm grateful to be here. If I could get my slides up, that'd be great. I won't tick through all this, but. I've been here as an attendee many times, and it's a privilege to be up here on the panel today. I think I'm here as the state guy. I was supposed to have an originalist theory of state power over immigration, but I'm also the husband to a woman who immigrated here 18 years ago as a refugee, so I know that the subject of immigration and the originalist questions we can ask about it is broad, but I'm going to be focused, like Genius today, on questions of power and how to cauterize the bleeding of what we were dealing with for the last 4 years of kind of mass illegal entry into the country. So I think on the screen, that's my son and I visiting the buoys down on the border. He's always been a precocious child, but we still don't understand how he managed to touch a non-justiciable political question. That's him. that's him touching the razor buoys. So I also want to hit on something that Gene brought up. I think part of why this panel is so important, why I'm thankful that FedSoc is having it and that we're debating it, is I think our theory of immigration as an original matter is woefully under-theorized because of some semantic confusion in the mid-20th century. So this is Justice Blackmun writing in, I can't pronounce it. But the claim there is that there was basically unrestricted movement into the United States until 1875. That's not true. It's about as wrong as someone could possibly be. And the sentence would be more correct if it read like that. So for the first century, states actually were the ones acting in this space, enacted numerous laws to prevent the entry of individuals. They actually repatriated and removed individuals from their states, to other countries. And so how did we get so confused about that? I think part of the answer is that we've collapsed the distinct concepts of immigration and naturalization. I think Gene hit on this. I think Justice Sullivan hit on this a moment ago. The Constitution lists the naturalization power under Congress's enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4. And migration is referenced only fleetingly in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1, which Justice Sullivan brought up. Ironically, in a provision that is denying powers to Congress for a period of time until 1808. And so the question becomes, where does any sovereign get the authority to regulate immigration? I think Gene hit it on the head. It's an inherent attribute of sovereignty. And so what I would argue today, if we're setting to one side what all our current precedent looks like, is that we mean what we say when we say that states are sovereign. They have sovereign immunity. They enact distinct legal codes. They adjudicate them. They execute them. That they likewise have an inherent authority to protect their territorial integrity. I think that's why this is the first, I won't be able to go through all this, but for the first 100 years, as I mentioned, states were enacting laws, so it was, laws that prevented the importation of individuals that dealt with people that were likely to become a public charge. And these cases eventually bubbled up to the Supreme Court, and there's a handful of opinions that basically approved states' power in this area. So, in Milne, which I'm sure we can maybe talk more about later, state of New York required a ship captain to provide a report listing the names, date of birth, age, sex of alien passengers who were disembarking into the state of New York, and imposed a fine if the ship captain didn't comply with that. And the Supreme Court upheld that and said that essentially states have the same power as foreign nations to exclude individuals from their territory. It also went to great lengths to say that and we gotta be precise here, that the movement of people across sovereign boundary lines was not commerce. Human trafficking is not commerce. And that the reality is that's what we saw along the Texas-Mexico border for 4 years, was literal labor and sex trafficking of women and children. That is not commerce in the sense of the Constitution. That's what the Supreme Court said. About 40 years later, in a different case, the court would say, the state couldn't impose a surcharge on the ship captain for bringing people in, because now all of a sudden you are injecting yourself into the commercial transaction for the service of riding a boat from, the UK to the United States. But at a certain point, that commercial transaction stops, and there's a question of sovereign power about exclusion or admission into a sovereign territory. I can unpack more, but that's kind of the top line stuff that I'll say on that.
So kind of open this up to everybody, because I think it's an important point. What are the relevant provisions of our Constitution to which the tools of originalism need to be applied so that we can better understand what the law is when it comes to the issue of immigration? Kind of throw that open for everybody. Trevor says it's not just the naturalization clause, so which others? Anybody?
So I told you that their tools involve text and history and structure. Structure is understanding the document as a whole in historical context, and we talk all the time about separation of powers or checks and balances or federalism or the rule of law, the unitary executive. So sovereignty is another one of these concepts. We need to get it straight. My first article as a law professor is called Of Sovereignty and Federalism. It's one of the 10 most cited articles of the last 40 years by scholars. I think it's been cited 9 times or so by the Supreme Court, but who's counting? I am.
He'll get an email on his phone there if it gets cited again.
So. And across the political spectrum, across the juridical spectrum. And this is a pretty important idea. It's at the heart of the new book, Born Equal. And I know I'm with a bunch of Texans, and Texas once was sovereign. You know, it's part of the six. No, it's not, with all due respect. And we did fight a civil war about this, and Mr. Lincoln was right. And you have to read the book to see that Mr. Lincoln was right. Mr. Lincoln was right. Mr. Lincoln was right. And
well, I agree.
It actually has some meaning. So, you know, sovereignty goes back to Westphalia in 1648, and sovereign entities can make treaties, and Texas can't today, and it could as a Lone Star Republic. So some of what I'm going to be saying is going to be embraced by my friends on that side of the aisle, and some not. So sovereignty does mean that even in the absence of a specific clause, I do agree that the federal government has inherent powers over its borders. And there are implied powers. They're not plenary powers, but they're implied powers. And reread, please, McCulloch versus Maryland. I've taught it 50 times, and I teach it paragraph by paragraph, and some of you have suffered through it as my former students. And it doesn't actually rely on the necessary and proper clause for any affirmative weight. John Marshall has already decided that there's a power over the bank before he gets to the necessary and proper clause, and there's no bank clause in the Constitution, but he said the whole thing was designed for national security, and a bank is pretty darn useful for national security, and that's why people vote for the Constitution, and that's actually what he says in McCulloch versus Maryland. So there are inherent powers of the federal government, and control of the border would be one of them, and that's connected to sovereignty and how we interact with foreign nations, and states don't get to do many of these things unless they're permitted by the federal government, expressly or impliedly, because they involve Mexico and Canada and the rest of the world. So that's why structure is important, and getting structure right is important, and sovereignty is a key word. That's why the first article I ever wrote was called Of Sovereignty and Federalism. It's 100 pages, and oh, you should read it, okay? Because it's relevant today on all sorts of things, and states can push back in certain ways, and they can't in other ways. One final thing, because actually precision is important here, and you're asking what does the Constitution say and not say? And I'm saying structurally, you have to understand it. Everyone has been talking about the Commerce Clause. That's actually a mistake. Read it with care, because there are certain things that are commercial, narrowly economic, federal government can't do. If I actually, my next door neighbor, if I find a fossil on my property and I sell it to my next door neighbor, well, that might be economic, but it's not interstate. And the federal government actually shouldn't be messing with that. So in fact, the word commerce can be read in a couple of ways. It can be read in the narrow way to involve things that involve buying and selling things. It has MERC, like mercantile, merchandise, merchant. But That wouldn't explain, for example, why there's power over navigation, which there is, and transportation, which there is, and I would say immigration, which there is, and actually animals going from one state to another, whether they're actually bought or sold or not. They may be migratory creatures. They may be viruses, actually. So here's the other way to read the so-called Commerce Clause. This is in my book, America's Constitution, a biography, 2005. It's one page, and it's a different reading of what you all call the Commerce Clause. So first of all, there's a second textual interpretation that's not about buying and selling things. It's in OED. It means just affairs, transactions, matters, stuff. And some of the OED entries of this are from actually way before the Constitution's adoption. Why do we, and the clause is best understood from a structural point of view to give Congress power to regulate all affairs, matters, transactions, not in a plenary way, that are connected to the Indians or the foreign nations or that are involved between the states. It's actually the with, that's why we call it the Bureau of Indian Affairs, whether it's narrowly economic or not. And the word affairs appeared in the Articles of Confederation, and if it doesn't mean affairs in the Constitution, oh, the Constitution has less power over the Indians federally than the Articles, and that would be weird. And the first Congress passes a statute saying, don't rile up the Indians, whether economically or not, and unless commerce is actually read to mean affairs, it's really hard to actually have federal power over Indian affairs. But if it means affairs when it comes to the Native American tribes, it means affairs when it comes to other foreign nations, and it means affairs between the states. So it shouldn't be called the Commerce Clause, because you could have economic things that are intrastate that Congress can't regulate, and you have things that are non-economic but involve crossing borders, whether economically or not, that Congress should regulate if it's crossing state borders or international borders or tribal borders. So we should actually call it the With and Among Clause. So let me just read it to you now under this different interpretation. Congress shall have power to regulate commerce, which is the same thing as affairs, affairs with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. That's a more coherent, structural account of that text to fit with the purposes of the federal government as a whole, the with or among clause. And it also means, as a practical matter, that, again, just to repeat, if it's economic but not interstate or international, Congress shouldn't be doing it. And if it is interstate or international with the Indian tribes, that is a federal function and history. So I've given you text, I've given you structure, I'm giving you history now because the Articles of Confederation did that with the Native American tribes, and the first Congress in the statute signed by George Washington did that. That's originalism. Well done. Text, history, structure by someone who has spent 40 years writing 8 books about every provision of the Constitution. That's why I said earlier, originalism is as originalism does, and I'm applying the same rules here that apply to the Fourth Amendment or the 11th Amendment or anything else.
Fascinating. We go to Trevor for a possible counterpoint, and I do agree with Abe Lincoln, but
thank you.
So yeah, that was helpful. Thank you. So I feel pretty good right now. It sounds like we agree that states did have authority over migration for the first 100 years, that the constitutional text supports that, that the practice of state legislature supports it, that congressional debate supported it, and the century Supreme Court precedent supports it as well. What I took my friend to be saying is that the Reconstruction Amendments fundamentally altered that and made states no longer sovereigns. I disagree. I think I would agree with half of that, and I think my friend has overlooked an important question if we're being precise, which is how did the Reconstruction Amendments alter state sovereignty? They certainly did and abrogated pre-existing sovereign powers to a degree. I think it would be very easy for all of us to imagine some examples of ways that the 13th and 14th Amendments might restrict certain ways that states could go about restricting migration into their territories. But my friend said, well, we need to look at the structure. Structure is what really matters. Let's think of a provision of the Constitution that was not changed by the Reconstruction Amendments. How about Article 4, Section 3, Clause 1, that talks about the territories and the boundaries of states? And the arrangement that our founders adopted at the founding was states could alter their boundaries only with the approval of Congress. So the federal sovereign has a say in the territorial movements of the sovereigns that are nested within its territorial bounds. But at the same time, Congress could not alter the territories of a state without the approval of that state. You have a baseline in our Constitution and our structure of sovereigns being sovereign over their territory. None of that changed in the Reconstruction Amendments. I think it's helpful also to note that Henderson, after the Supreme Court case that I had up there earlier, enjoined a state imposition of a surcharge on ship captains as violative of the Commerce Clause, or Dormant Commerce Clause, I guess, did not disavow that Milne decision or the Moore decision, and that's after Reconstruction. I think it's a creative argument to suggest that commerce means more broadly intercourse. I do agree that there is a gulf between how we think about the Indian Commerce Clause and the interstate and foreign commerce clause. But I think it's interesting to note if what we care about is the structure and how these provisions were viewed at the founding. In 1790, Congress passed the first Naturalization Act, so implementing the federal government's authority to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. And so you might think that that's an area where it's clear states have less role to play because we're not dealing with implied inherent powers of sovereign governments like in immigration, but Congress has been given an express enumerated power over that. We can imagine ways in which states having different rules of naturalization would wreak havoc. But the law that Congress passed said that individuals who reside in the United States may be admitted into citizenship unless or provided that that person has not heretofore been proscribed by any state. It's interesting to me that in the first 2 years after the Constitution was ratified, Congress viewed state authority even over the enumerated naturalization power to be concurrent. And I don't think anything in the Reconstruction Amendments changes that.
Stephanie, you had a thought?
So just very briefly, and I hesitate to comment as someone who hasn't written 9 books yet, Akhil, but I do think that, I do think it's a fair point that both at the founding and Reconstruction, state sovereignty was limited in important ways, as Trevor alludes to. But your point that the free state of Texas can't enter treaties, that's true because the Constitution is directly giving treaty power shared by the President and Congress. But I think it's a weaker argument that the same is true when it comes to immigration power and that that was taken away from states because, as we're discussing, there's a less clear enumerationist spot to point to in the Constitution that's giving that power and certainly in an exclusive way to the federal government, which is why Justice Scalia in his dissent in U.S. versus Arizona marshals a lot of textual and historical evidence I'd point you to in terms of why the states didn't understand themselves to be giving up that power either at the founding or Reconstruction. They maintained that as part of their sovereign power. Now, of course, Congress could preempt states if Congress passed legislation that states were conflicting with, but Scalia's argument there is if states are doing things to just enforce more rigorously federal policies that are already on the books, then there's no problem there. No conflict between those two different types of sovereign authorities. And as Trevor points out, a sovereign authority that was exercised much more frequently, and there's a much more longstanding tradition of that by the states from the founding and moving forward for quite some time than there was of the federal government, which was limited to the Alien Acts. And maybe, as my friend Kurt Lash has argued, their treatment of regulating immigration with respect to Native American tribes, but states were doing that too with respect to Native American tribes.
So to be clear, I never said anything, and we can roll the tape about Reconstruction, not one word yet. When we talk about birthright citizenship, I will. I made an entirely founding argument, so my friend Trevor just misheard me because he was expecting me maybe to say some things, but I said a different thing. I'm saying from day one, the states are not sovereign, and indeed, let me tell you that the Articles of Confederation uses the word sovereign. It's in Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation. Each state retains its sovereignty, independence, and freedom, you know, except for things given exclusively to the Confederation Congress, and that language is omitted from the Constitution, and everyone understands that and sees that, and that's in Washington's transmittal letter accompanying actually the Constitution itself. So Constitution text is not just what is in it, but what isn't in it. And history is, again, not everything that's ever happened. I'm not that interested in Mill, and it's neither here nor there. It's not actually a founding, you know, moment. It's many years later. It's from the Tawney Court, which is going to, I think, give us Dred Scott. Maybe it's, I think it is the Tawney Court.
1837.
Yeah. So states were sovereign under the Articles of Confederation. That was eliminated in the Constitution itself. The Federalists say that again and again, and the Anti-Federalists actually bemoan that. If Lincoln is right, he's right. There's no Reconstruction Amendments yet, okay? He's right under the original Constitution. Now, I don't need to take the position, and I haven't really researched it enough, about whether states have certain powers above, you know, in addition to or concurrently with the federal government. But yes, from the beginning, the federal government, and here I'm, I think, with my a new friend, that there is inherent power of the federal government from the beginning over borders. Now, many states, of course, have borders, not just with other states, but internationally. So I can completely accept, I think, the thought that the early Congresses actually, there's not a lot of government capacity at the beginning, are sharing and deputizing and working with in cooperative federalism ways all sorts of states. But Stephanie, I think you agree with me that when push comes to shove, ultimately, these are federal competences, definitely today, but I would say even before the Reconstruction Amendments, right?
If by federal competence you mean the federal government can preempt states,
yes.
I agree.
Yes, great.
Yeah. So, you know, this, I just saw this in here, obscure provision, 10th Amendment, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And somebody's got a hot mic. And I agree. I think that my federal counterpart court has referred to a residuary sovereignty reposed in the states. But this one does sound pretty sovereign in the way that we're talking about here. Not coining money or mark and reprisal, but Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. And Gene pointed to this, the counterpart provision in Article 4, Section 4, about the federal government's duty to defend the states against invasion. So, Gene, do you have a perspective on this states issue, looking at it from the perspective of having counseled the federal executive on this, and where the kind of the implied executive power that comes with being a sovereign? Thoughts?
It is an interesting debate. It's an interesting proposition to consider. I think that, you know, it would be strange, given the Supremacy Clause and given some of these express enumerated powers, for example, for a state to, despite the existence of a provision in the INA that governs the admission of a particular alien into the United States for some particular purpose. So say you are coming here to receive an H-1B, on an H-1B visa, the Congress has enumerated this power. The person applies to the executive, respective executive departments. They go through, they get admitted, and then they get to live in the United States. I think that it would be odd if a state, of course, tried to pass some kind of its own immigration law, right? We would all, I think, recognize that that's preempted by the Supremacy Clause, by the existence of this, of the INA, in terms of bringing someone in to the United States. I think that where there was conflict with existing provisions in the INA about whether or not someone can be deported presents another interesting inflection point that we have to be very precise about. But I think that where, though, a lot of attention has not been spent as a matter of scholarship, as a matter of practice, as a matter of anything, is what happens when the federal government completely abdicates its responsibility to prevent people from coming into a state. Does that state not have the inherent power to guard its own borders, given all of these provisions? I think that presents a different question. It's a different issue. We have to be very precise. We have to consider all of these things in tandem. And I would, this morning, to all of the many academics and young law students and folks who are out there, as a personal matter, I would encourage each and every one of you to engage in more research and more scholarship to analyze these issues from these perspectives. There's not enough scholarship, I think, detailed scholarship, other than my new friend here, on some of these issues. There's a few other angles, but really and truly, especially from the perspective of somebody who is a member of the Federalist Society, who adheres to originalism as the means and method through which you interpret the Constitution and, of course, any enacting legislation, but just to study and to spend more time on these issues and to consider afresh, anew, without any bias, based on historical, I think, in many ways, problematic practices or jurisprudence, as Trevor has pointed out here, failed understandings, even amongst Supreme Court justices in the past, of what was actually occurring. And I would just add to this also that one of the things that we have to just bear in mind when it comes to the contours of executive power, inherent executive power, which is, of course, always, it's all of it is vested in the president. And we're looking at this, what provisions govern the admission of individuals into the United States? Is there commerce? Is it naturalization? What are all these different provisions? We also have to consider the history at the time. And the fact of the matter is that the United States was not yet the United States. I mean, it was as an entity, but it was originally 13 colonies. There was a lot of unsettled territory. The landmass that we now know as the United States was not fully settled. There were existing groups of people who were here, but we have to understand that the existence of a landmass that's largely unsettled, largely uncontrolled territory, presents a very different scenario at that point in time when we look at some of the historical practices. For instance, if you are a person who says that, you know, immigration was uncontrolled until the late 1800s by the federal government. Well, there was also a lot of land to settle and to colonize and to claim. And so factually speaking on the ground, it's a very different scenario versus today, when clearly we have borders, clearly we have a territory, and clearly that we are no longer in a position in which we are encouraging people to come here to help colonize and claim land. It's already been claimed. The borders are closed. The next, I don't know where the next place is going to be for us. Maybe Mars to colonize at some point in time, but our borders are closed. And so we have to recognize that distinction there as well in terms of the state's ability to act. The federal government's ability to act to protect the citizenry that's within its own borders.
So one of the things, when you read through this document, you see a lot of different words used to refer to human beings. And we've seen discussion of this different terminology play out when it comes to is the process that is due at the border different because it's at the border. We have we the people, you have person, citizen, inhabitant, resident, subject in Article 3, Section 2, talking about controversies between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens, or subjects. So, Akhil, a lot of the new book touches on this. What meaning does an originalist draw from the differing terminology used as an intratextualist throughout the document.
I agree. I agree with my friend Trevor that what process is due is going to vary tremendously, and people at the border who just come in maybe illegally. I think they're entitled to due process, but the question is how much process is due? And the answer is perhaps not very much. Do have a free weekly podcast. You can get CLE credit. There's a whole episode just on this issue where I do take the position that, yes, of course, all persons are entitled to due process. And that was really important because one of the three things that the Dred Scott Court said is that only citizens have constitutional rights, that aliens had no rights to process, and the framers of the 14th Amendment disagreed with that. Those of you who believe in incorporation under the Privileges or Immunities Clause, as I do, as Clarence Thomas does, as most of the originalist justices do, we have to answer, gee, if privileges or immunities include things like speech, press, petition, assembly, free exercise, because they're in what we call the Bill of Rights, why isn't that also true of due process? And I think the answer is, well, it would be, so that's a privilege or immunity. So why do you need then the due process clause if it's already covered? And the answer, because they asked John Bingham that, is he said, oh, we want to protect aliens as well. The stranger at our gates is entitled to protection. He's quoting Deuteronomy. Actually, you must be kind to the stranger at your gates, because once you were a stranger in a strange land, he's talking about Babylonian exile and slavery under Pharaoh's Egypt. So they believed very much that persons had rights beyond to fair procedures, beyond citizens. But the question is, what processes do? And I think that does vary tremendously, whether you're, let's say, a green card holder, you've been here for 30 years, you've done everything legal, you've married an American citizen, you're a parent of an American citizen, you leave the country temporarily because your parent in the old country dies and now you want to come back. Oh, you're going to be entitled to a lot more process when they try to stop you at JFK, or if they try to deport you, then someone who, I think, that to use Trevor's metaphor, is playing the hokey pokey. Now, one final thing, since we're talking about what originalism is and intertextualism and words and which words you use and which words you don't use, I just want to read you the language of the Articles of Confederation so you hear how different even the 10th Amendment is from that. So here's the Articles. Article 2, it's very important. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation, expressly delegated to the United States and Congress assembled. Now, the Constitution tracks that and deviates from it in really key ways, and this is originalism, the words that are used and not used in historical context. Okay, and we're not talking about Greece or Rome or, whatever Roe versus Wade was trying to do. I can't quite figure it out. So first of all, the Constitution omits that word sovereign, and everyone notices that. And John and George Washington makes a big deal of that in his transmitted letter, and the Anti-Federalists don't like it, but that's a pointed omission. Next, they get rid of the word expressly. They omit it in the Necessary and Proper Clause, and they omit it again in the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment sounds a little bit like this, about reserved powers. So the Constitution, actually, when you read the Necessary and Proper Clause and the 10th Amendment against Article 2, here are three fundamental points. No more state sovereignty. Yes, implied powers of the federal government, which John Marshall emphasizes, not plenary, but implied, which John Marshall emphasizes in McCulloch versus Maryland. And under the 10th Amendment, once again, the word expressly is omitted, actually. So once again, there are, and it was proposed by South Carolinian, and James Madison actually opposes that, and successfully so. So you're absolutely right, Your Honor. You have to look at how words fit together within a document. That's intratextualism. Thanks for that plug. It was an article I wrote. It's now actually in Black's Law Dictionary as a word, as an entry. So, but there's looking at words within a document, inhabitant, person, citizen, how do they all fit together, due process, which is repeated a couple times, but also how things work across documents, and especially, and this is what you invoked with Justice Barrett, the predecessor documents of the Constitution are going to be particularly relevant here if you're doing originalism the right way. The predecessor documents being the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the state constitutions. And you can especially see this with comparing the 10th Amendment to Article 2. It's a short little exercise. I commend to you all. Just look carefully at Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation, compare and contrast it with the 10th Amendment.
Go over to T-Bone real quick, and then Stephanie, I've got a question for you.
Sure. And I'll if I can get my slides back up, I'm going to go to advance your slide in a second. But I want to apologize, Professor Marr. I did not mean to make a straw man of your argument. I genuinely thought that a century of American practice by the states, Congress, SCOTUS, settled for me what the structural question was. I think it's informative that Article 4, Section 3, Clause 1 lays out a framework where you have two sovereigns who both had territorial integrity. But I take your point. We're not talking about Reconstruction. But thinking of structure, I think Gene was talking about the self-defense authority earlier, and so that I might just give us a little history on that. Go back here. So in 1874, the Texas Governor Koch had made multiple demands of the president at the time along the lines of what Gene was talking about. The federal government has an obligation under Article 4 to protect states not only from domestic, but then external disturbances, invasions, insurrections. Texas is very grateful that on Inauguration Day, the governor sent a letter to the president invoking Article 4, and the president acted swiftly to provide the defense that Texas and the border lacked for the 4 years before that. But in 1874, the federal government did not respond for some time. And so Governor Koch wrote a letter to U.S. Attorney General Williams essentially saying, you have abdicated your obligations under Article 4. Mexico has abdicated its obligations under the Law of Nations to prevent excursions from its own territory into a neighbor's territory. And these repeated depredations by these criminal gangs who were murdering, destroying property, all that stuff amounted to an invasion under Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. So the governor finally issued orders to the Texas Rangers that said, expel these people entering the country in open defiance of our territorial sovereignty, and even pursue them back across the Rio Grande. It came to the attention of the federal government. Secretary of State wrote to Governor Koch and said, hey, what are you doing? And Governor Koch writes back, I think, a remarkably well-lawyered letter to the Attorney General. And at the end, he says, if you disagree with me that I don't have authority to Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, and you countermand me, you tell me to pull my order down, I will. And instead, this is a report from the Congressional Committee on the Texas Frontier Troubles. Congress's conclusion was that the Attorney General acquiesced in the conclusions of Governor Koch. That doesn't mean that's you know, the end-all be-all interpretation, but what you have there, like Gene was saying, was a backstop from a sovereign that also has territorial integrity and an interest in protecting its people, and the federal government acquiescing in the state's invocation of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 authority, even to the point of crossing an international boundary line to pursue people who were inflicting harm on the Texas border community. If I could just address preemption real quick, because I think that's come up. I want to make sure I hit that. I don't think it's weird. I don't think, so this is maybe where Gene and I disagree. I don't think it's all that weird for the federal government and the state to both have laws that pertain to immigration. It might not surprise many of folks in here that I don't really think that field preemption is a thing. If you do the history, you'll find that the first Supreme Court case that discusses field preemption was actually a conflict preemption case where they just used a metaphor, and this is what we do now. We just turn metaphors into doctrines. But the example I would give, and I think this is responsive to what Professor Amar was saying a moment ago, we have overlapping criminal codes across this country. The federal government and states criminalize the same exact conduct, and they either both punish it or one of them does and the other does not. And the Supreme Court blessed this in what is called the separate sovereigns doctrine a few years ago. I don't know how to square Professor Amar's view that states are not sovereign with the idea that they enact legal codes, that they wield the power of the sword and they punish, that they are able to punish conduct that the federal government likewise criminalizes. And most importantly for our debate here about immigration and what Gene was talking a moment ago about federal abandonment, I don't think anyone would say that if either one of those sovereigns, federal government chooses not, federal or state chooses not to prosecute an individual for murder, that is not ground preclusion on the other sovereign to not prosecute the same thing, right? So an exercise of enforcement discretion is in no way preemptive of the other sovereign's prescription of the same underlying activity.
And Stephanie, some of the provisions that we've not yet talked about in discussing immigration and originalism are the protections of religious liberties. Can you tell us how that enters into the conversation here?
Sure. Thanks for that. So my co-author Kurt Lash and I wrote an article recently that talked about and explored ways in which the history of the Reconstruction era shows that there was widespread understanding that religious resistance to the Fugitive Slave Act in order to protect individuals fleeing enslavement merited constitutional protection. And so there was certainly debate about that at the federal level. But this is a quote from Bingham about the impact he thought the 14th Amendment had for states. He said, before the 14th Amendment, a state, as in the case of a state of Illinois, could make it a crime punishable by fine and imprisonment for any citizen within her limits in obedience to the injunction of our divine master to help a slave who was ready to perish, to give him shelter or break with him his crust of bread. And Bingham's argument is that the 14th Amendment changed that, and now that sort of protection of these fleeing individuals with food or water is protected. Note that the Fugitive Slave Act is arguably a neutral and generally applicable law, and we have this constitutional protection anyway for this sort of act of religious exercise, which is relevant for one of many reasons why I think there's evidence that Smith was wrongly decided. But bracketing that, one concrete application of this sort of evidence also suggests that there ought to be protection for groups, including Catholic Charities or others, operating at the border who want to provide food and water to refugees. And there have been some calls in Congress to cut off funding for these sorts of groups. And there was a case in Arizona where one of these groups was sued. They won under RFRA, the District Court of Arizona, that they probably should win constitutionally as well with this sort of evidence. One other thing I'll just mention very briefly, because we haven't talked about birthright citizenship yet, but I think it's an important piece of this debate. And I'll just flag, I haven't written about this myself, but this is an area where I think your views of constitutional construction are important. And I'll just flag the issues that there's actually a lot of consensus about the birthright citizenship debate. Basically everyone agrees that it's not just a question of whether someone was born here or not, because the constitutional language says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So that's point number one. This is an argument Randy Barnett has made. Point number two is that jurisdiction had at least three categories that weren't subject to jurisdiction. So not everyone in the country is automatically subject to the country's jurisdiction. Ambassadors, occupying armies, and Native Americans were not automatically subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And then third, most people agree that subject to the jurisdiction thereof does not equate to just those three categories. In other words, there's some sort of underlying criteria that those three categories have in common that could at least hypothetically apply to other categories. And so the debate is, well, what's that criteria? And can it apply to other categories? And one other thing that I know Kurt Lash would argue and potentially Randy is that the position that the government has long taken with respect to birthright citizenship is probably a permissible constitutional construction. This might be an area where there's not one clear answer as a matter of constitutional interpretation. There might be some irreducible ambiguity, in which case what the government has done in the past is permissible, but it might also be permissible to take a different constitutional construction approach. And Lash bases that on historical evidence related to government treatment of Native Americans, and Randy and Alon Werman base that on common law approaches to the social compact. But the bottom line is that a lot rides then on what you think about constitutional construction. So I think Kurt would say, because this is a political constitutional construction that has long been taken, political branches can change it. So if the president wants to change the approach, he can. But my colleague John McKeil would say, well, it is a constitutional construction, but implied powers of this sort were given to Congress under the Necessary and Proper Clause. That's where they reside. And so if Congress hasn't acted to change it, then the court has to intervene if the executive is trying to override a congressional constitutional construction. So I just think it's an interesting area where how you think about constitutional construction can matter a lot to how you ultimately resolve that particular debate.
So our clock isn't running here. How much more time do we have?
It's over.
Minus 1 minute. All right.
Sorry.
Very good. I'm going to go ahead and grant a slight extension to myself.
You can be a judge in your own case.
So I want to thank all of our fantastic panelists. I'm sorry, Akhil, that people are just going to have to go buy the book to get point counterpoint on birthright citizenship. But I also want to echo the panelists in thanking the Federalist Society for gathering us here today to talk about this important issue. And I also want to echo the call for greater scholarship. We all, I think probably everybody in this room, understands why originalism is important. And I think it was, you know, keenly felt in the 2024 election that immigration is important. So I would echo that call for scholarship, for members of the academy, but also for outstanding practicing lawyers like Gene and like Trevor, and like a lot of you in the room here, doing that hard work so that when things come to people to do my job, they can, you know, figure out what the law is and not say what they think it ought to be or something like that. So please join me in giving a big round of applause to our outstanding panel here.